This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 3 years ago, U.S. and British forces stood poised on the Kuwaiti border. In a matter of weeks, they would topple Saddam Hussein's statue and his government and change the life of almost everyone in Iraq. Today, an opportunity to talk with Iraqis and ask them what's different, what's better, what's worse 3 years on, about what works and what doesn't, about daily life and their hopes and fears for the future. While we've done our best to find different kinds of people, we won't pretend that we found a representative sample. For one thing, all our guests speak English. But this is your chance to ask Iraqis about life in Iraq, so if you'd like to know more about jobs or cars or TV, about health care or electrical power or shopping or whatever, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. First, and almost inevitably, we begin with politics. Earlier today, Iraq's new parliament was sworn in. While some see this as a sign of progress, political parties still can't agree on the formation of a new government, and the first parliamentary session lasted just 30 minutes. Still, acting Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri said that with a little work, he believes the country can have a working government within a month. Our first guest is a member of the Iraqi parliament, Maysoon al-Damlouj. Maysoon, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, hello.
Tell us what that first session of the Iraqi parliament was like today.
Well, I was happy that it didn't have any surprises. We knew that our task today was to make an oath of allegiance to the country, to the unity of the country, and to stick together and to work to the best of our ability.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that. There were no surprises. So I think we are all thankful for that.
What do you make of the acting prime minister's statement that government could be formed in a month? Is that realistic, do you think?
Well, there is a lot of pressure to form a new government. Since the elections, things have deteriorated in a dramatic way. We almost had a civil war. Some say that the civil war has already started. And there is a lot of pressure on politicians to form a government of national unity. And I think they have started the negotiations and they are putting the new government together.
Mm-hmm. Your life has obviously changed a great deal over the past 3 years. Tell us a little bit about what you were doing before the war, what you're doing now.
Oh, I was an architect. I had my own practice before the war. I also worked in... I didn't live in Iraq. I lived abroad. I came back a couple of weeks after the fall of Saddam. The beginning of May, I was in Baghdad. And I stayed on. I continued to work in politics. I was the senior deputy minister of culture or undersecretary of culture until yesterday. That was my last day. And today I have become the new member of parliament.
Let's see if we can get a listener on the line. And why don't we start with Beth. Beth's calling from Laramie, Wyoming.
Yes, I was just curious as to how the rights of Iraqi women have changed since the U.S. occupation in Iraq.
Can you help us out, Maysoon al-Damlouj?
Of course. I'm also, I should have said, I'm also an activist on women's issues. The life of women has changed dramatically as well. Before the fall, there was security in the streets. People could walk freely without the fear of kidnappers or car bombs or any kind of insurgency attacks and all that. Things are not the case anymore. There is a lot of fear. Women fear for their children going to school and back and all that. But women have achieved a lot politically since the change of the regime. We have worked hard and managed to get a quota of no less than 25% of women in parliament. We're now working to get capable women to go into government as well and also into other key positions like the presidential deputy, vice president and deputy prime minister and all that, to have women in key positions. So it is not an easy answer. I cannot say it has got better or worse. women now have better opportunities than they ever did before. However, unfortunately, the lack of security always gives way to extremists to take over the streets. Extremists of all types, especially religious extremists, and they can impose their own laws on women, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. For instance, many women have are now covering up their hair. They wear the hijab just because they are too scared not to.
Yeah.
And this is very unfortunate. However, we feel that this will go as soon as law and order are reinstalled in Iraq. Reinstated.
Beth, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to this is Linda. Linda's calling us from Eau Claire in Wisconsin.
Hello, thank you for taking my call, and
sure.
Thank you for this show. I am a women's health nurse, and I am particularly interested in how the war has affected the care that women receive, pregnant women, young infants. How has the war affected the delivery of adequate prenatal care, and what are the conditions in the hospitals for those women who are able to deliver in hospital, and for those who aren't, can you tell us about how they are managing?
Maysoon.
Yes, this is a very good question, actually. The health system has gradually collapsed since 1990, since the sanctions were imposed on Iraq. For instance, in 2003, when the change took place, the woman hadn't even heard of some things like, for instance, smear tests or mammograms or stuff like that. Now we have special clinics for women for these kinds of tests. In general, the health care is very poor in Iraq. It has been, as I said, slowly deteriorating since the sanctions were imposed in 1990. In the last 3 years, there has been a serious attempt to, provide enough medicines, for stuff like diabetes, for instance, or high blood pressure, etc. However, I think it is still extremely poor. Health education is also extremely poor. Clinics are extremely out of date. Computers have just started to go into hospitals and things like that. Iraq was a leading nation in the Middle East in healthcare in the 70s. Unfortunately, this is not the situation anymore at all.
Linda, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask you one more question before we let you go.
Okay.
You're a woman member of parliament. I would assume at this point the lives of every member of parliament are at risk. Can you walk freely along the street? Do you have to have bodyguards everywhere you go?
Yes, I've had bodyguards since, I would say, October of 2003. Soon after the bombing started to occur, the UN bombings, etc. But the number of my bodyguards have been increasing gradually. Yes, I do go out in an entourage of cars around me, surrounding me. I still feel that it's not enough. And anyway, if a car bomb or someone detonates a bomb with a remote control, what good are the bodyguards? In fact, I once was in the middle of two car bombs. I wasn't being targeted. It was the Minister of Interior who happened to be driving nearby, and it was extremely scary. People are still not trained how to deal with these car bombs, although we've been having an average of two or three car bombs per day. But people act, especially the police, they act extremely foolishly after any car bomb. They start shooting aimlessly. And when I was in the middle of the two car bombs, I could hear bullets passing, right beside my head. I was rushed into an open door. It happened to be a kitchen where some women were peeling potatoes. Thankfully, I survived it. And you learn to become fatalistic when you live in these kind of circumstances.
Maysoon,
Maysoon
Al-Dumluj, thank you very much for being with us today, and good luck to you.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for calling. Bye-bye.
She's a member of the Iraqi parliament and joined us on the phone from Baghdad. Joining us now is Amelia Templeton. She's a senior at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. She and some of her friends at Swarthmore wanted to know more about what daily life was like for Iraqis. And over the past year, they made some phone calls. Amelia joins us now from a studio in Philadelphia. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Your project is called War News Radio. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, about a year and a half ago, a Swarthmore alumni who works for CBS started talking to students and faculty about what we could do, I guess, to get more information about what was going on in Iraq, because most of us felt like we really knew very little about the country and knew the least about what life was like for Iraqi citizens, not just what they thought of the American occupation, mm-hmm. but whether or not they had water and electricity and whether they were going to college, what had stopped and what had kept going. So we started this program, War News Radio, and really the core of the program is phone calls to Iraq and discussions with Iraqi citizens about their life and their opinions.
And how many Iraqis would you say you've spoken with?
I think personally I've probably spoken with around 30 Iraqis.
Hmm.
That's just an estimate on my part, but something like that.
If you've learned something that surprises you, what is it?
Well, I think the most surprising thing I've learned, there are probably two things. The first is how little what's going on in Iraq has to do with the U.S. sometimes. We are, you know, glued to our TVs and listening to George Bush and, you know, the Democrats in the Senate and Congress fighting this out. And Iraqis are listening to Ayatollah Sistani and their own politicians and their community leaders and their families. And really, in many ways, this situation is not in our hands, I guess. And that was quite surprising to me at first.
When we come back, Amelia is going to introduce her to some of the people she's contacted in Iraq and your opportunity to talk with them as well. 800-989-8255. What do you want to know about what life is like in Iraq? Talk at NPR.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Iraqis about what life is like today in Iraq. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Amelia Templeton, a reporter for War News Radio at Swarthmore College in Philadelphia. And Amelia, if you could introduce us to the first contact.
Sure. First, I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Taha Ahmed Abdul Salam. And Mr. Salam lives in Baghdad, and he's currently the CEO of the Iraqi Stock Exchange. He also worked for the exchange under the former regime, and he holds a master's degree in economics. He does not identify himself as a Sunni or Shia, but just as an Iraqi citizen.
Hmm.
Welcome, Mr. Salam.
You're welcome.
Nice to have you on the program, Mr. Salam. I think people might be surprised that there was an Iraqi stock exchange.
Thank you.
What kind of companies are listed on the exchange? What kind of volume do you do?
We have in Iraqi stock exchange 94 companies listed. They represent many sectors, just like banks, industrial company, hotels, services, agricultural companies, and investment companies. And the number of shares listed in the market, it's about 432 billion shares. And the market capitalization, it's about $2 billion.
And are you growing?
I believe very, very slowly, yes. We just start our work in the year 2004. The first session held in Iraq Stock Exchange was in June 24, 2004.
Hmm.
And we are held now two sessions in a week, Monday and Wednesday from 10 to 12 only.
Now, Mr. Salam, last time we spoke, you had all of those companies and shares written up on big whiteboards. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is still the case. It's still a white board, plastic board, and the brokers write on it in two sides. Each company have one board. It has two sides, one for the buyer and the other for the seller.
Let's get a question in from a caller. This is Sharon. Sharon's calling us from Philadelphia.
Yes. The question I had was, how have things changed since the fall of the Saddam regime compared to now? Do you feel that your freedoms are greater, or as far as how you live day to day, is it a constant state of anxiety, or do you rise above that and do you have, you know, pockets where maybe it's better than it was before? And I just wanted to get a comparison about what it is like now.
You know, the old regime, many kinds of works are not allowed to other people. Just like example, in the past, I don't have an email. I don't have phone, my own phone, cell phone. We cannot make website. About the stock exchange, especially about the stock exchange, in the past, the price was limited up and down about 5%, and you know, the inflation at that time was $1 equal 2,000 Iraqi dinar. Now the prices in the market are free, but you know, the economic now, it's not health because of many attacking from the terrorists and other things, just like the electricity and the water. Many things are not in good condition, but about the stock exchange, it is work just like in the manual way, but it is safely, and it's growing up, but very slowly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. How do you get to work every day?
I go to work as usual from 8 to 2. 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. By my car.
And is it easy to get gasoline? Do you have to pass through checkpoints on the way from your home to work?
No, I send some of my employee to fill my car with the gasoline, and I spend many times in the road because of the jam of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And many roads are cut it. Because of security situation.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Richard. Richard with us on the line from South Carolina.
Hi. Hello.
Hello, Richard. Go ahead, please.
How you doing? I'm going to be in Iraq in 10 days. I'm in the military. I just wanted to ask what we can do as military members to help the Iraqi citizens, because we just want to help. We want to, you know, make their lives better for them, and then we all want to come home. What can we do as soldiers and Marines and airmen and Navy personnel?
Mr. Salam.
Yes. You know, it is not easy to tell you what you can to do. But if you treat the people very nicely, and especially the women, the kids, and the old, if you, I saw many times many soldiers help other people. If someone hit him by car or fire happened here and there, they help the people, and they make very useful helping to the people. So those people respect this kind of help. But I don't have many plans, military plans. I don't know so much in military's kind.
Mm-hmm. Be nice to people. I think that's sort of a universal, Richard.
Thank you.
Okay, good luck to you.
All right, bye.
And Mr. Salam, thank you so much for being with us today. Good luck to you as well, and good luck with your enterprise at the Iraqi Stock Exchange.
Thank you, sir.
Taha Ahmed Abdul Salam joined us on the line from Baghdad. Still with us is Amelia Templeton at War News Radio at Swarthmore College. But let me introduce now John Burns, New York Times Baghdad bureau chief, who's been covering the Iraq war on and off for the past 3 years and more, just returned from Iraq last week. He's now traveling on the West Coast. And John, thanks very much for taking the time out from your break to speak with us today.
It's a pleasure.
We've had a little bit of update on the progress or lack of same in the formation of a new parliament. We're trying to talk with the Iraqis today about what their lives are like. And over the past 3 years, how have things changed?
How have things changed?
For Iraqis, do you think?
Well, I suppose for Iraqis, as for Americans, you could say the trajectory of this war has been a series of checkpoints at which there has been a hope and at times expectation of improvement, followed by further deterioration at every stage. I mean, obviously the elections, the three votes last year, the two mm-hmm. elections and the one referendum, with those turnouts, those astonishing turnouts, ultimately nearly 12 million people in December, were constituted one of those points where those of us who had followed the miseries of this war allowed ourselves to hope on December the 15th that there had been a decisive turn, and unfortunately there wasn't. We're back to political squabbling. The circumstances of the Iraqi people continue to deteriorate. I think I'm right in saying that the amount of electricity flowing through the grid is now at its lowest level since the American incursion 3 years ago. The war doesn't get any better. In some ways, it gets worse. And there is, as far as I can see, no light at the end of this tunnel.
You mentioned the electrical power. What's the situation with other elements of basic infrastructure, water, roads, phone systems, that sort of thing?
Miserable. Miserable. Now, I have to say that that is not a basis on which to make an easy indictment of the American effort in Iraq, other than the argument that is made, of course, by the opponents of this war, that the United States should not have gone there in the first place. But the fact that the very expensive reconstruction program, which I think has cost the American taxpayers to date in excess of $20 billion, has not brought about the sorts of improvements that everybody hoped it was of course due primarily to the insurgency. So I think it's not entirely fair to blame the United States for these failures, as many Iraqis do, by the way, based, I suppose, very simply and from their point of view, understandably, on the fact that things deteriorated from the point that they were under Saddam. They weren't good under Saddam. They got worse. But I think that we need to keep clearly fixed in our minds as to who the principal culprits for this failure, this reconstruction program are, and that is the insurgents who, as you know, blow up pipelines, attack, as they did quite recently, a power station, a newly renovated power station, and reduce it to rubble, and make or travel along the roads between the cities a lottery for all, Iraqis and Americans, a lottery with death.
Mm-hmm.
So the situation is worse and than it was in April 2003 and continuing to get worse.
A couple of weeks ago, I think you were still in Baghdad at that point, there was a curfew after, the worst of the ethnic violence erupted after the mosque was bombed in Samarra, which led to some questions about how people get around it and do their business of daily life. What about the markets? Are there wide varieties of food available? At what kind of a price?
Well, you know, we are frequently assailed for the things we don't report, or particularly by people who support this war, who say we don't reflect the realities, the positive realities of Iraq. Whether that's true or not, I think it's fair to say that there is a kind of counterpoint visible in Baghdad every day. It was illustrated by your speaker just a few minutes ago, who heads the Iraqi Stock Exchange, describing driving to work every day as if it's the most normal thing in the world. Well, people like him have been regularly assassinated. Anybody who associates himself with not just with the American occupation of Iraq as they see it, but with the functioning of the Iraqi state and its institutions and its commercial institutions is prone to be assassinated. Here's a fellow talking as though it's the most normal thing in the world about driving to work every day. Well, the fact is that the commerce in Baghdad is thriving. It tends to be, it's not macroeconomics, it's microeconomics. It is markets. It's the sale of white goods. It's the purchase of motor vehicles, which have caused the biggest traffic jams in the history of Iraq by a long way. So there are indicators that point in the opposite direction, and my conclusion from that is that People are endlessly inventive and brave, and they find ways to continue living their lives in as way in fashion that is as close as possible to normal, despite circumstances that we as outsiders would regard as completely impossible.
We are talking today with Iraqis. At the moment, we're talking with John Burns, the chief Baghdad bureau chief of the New York Times, and with Amelia Templeton, a reporter for War News Radio at Swarthmore College. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Sal. Sal's calling us from Woodbridge in Virginia.
Hi, am I on air?
Yes, you are. Go ahead, please.
All right. First, I want to thank the two ladies who the first callers who asked about the Iraqi women.
Yes.
I'm an Iraqi American, or better say American. Iraqi women are not in good shape. I went back to Iraq almost 2 years ago. Not in good shape. And also, I want to answer the soldier who asked what to do to help Iraqis.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say, God bless you. I don't think the situation is that easy, but all I want to say, don't leave Iraq for Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda is going to destroy Iraq. Sorry, I'm jamming the traffic. I can't talk that much.
Okay, Sal. Drive carefully, please.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the phone call.
Thanks.
And let's see if we can get someone else up. This is Sarah. Sarah's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, am I there?
Yes, you are. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I wanted to ask a member of the media or an Iraqi, either one, do you think that America and media is misrepresenting what's going on in general in Iraq?
Amelia Templeton, from what you learn talking to so many Iraqis over the course of the last year or so, what do you think?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say the American media is misrepresenting what's going on in Iraq, but there are many barriers to getting an accurate picture of what's going on, and I think that all of us, myself, members of the mainstream media, understand that talking to a limited number of sources, there are things that we just still don't know. You know, what is the situation in Al-Anbar province? If I'm not there, it can be hard to figure out. And there's a lot of contradictory information. I think in the past year, the media has done a much better job of following some of the stories other than car bombings and other than the violence and sort of making inquiries into, well, what is the state of the electricity sector? How are people doing? So I think, I wouldn't say misrepresenting, but I think it's an endlessly complicated situation and we're sort of starting from scratch. You know, most of us didn't know anything about Iraqi politics before this began and there's a lot to learn.
John Burns, let me ask you that same question, and part of it is how easy is it for reporters to get around inside Iraq?
Well, in my judgment, and I've spent a great deal of my more than 30 years at the New York Times covering wars, this is about as dangerous a situation as you can imagine for reporters. It's true that Chechnya is what it was, an extremely dangerous place to go, as was Somalia, but people didn't base themselves there in the main. We are resident in Iraq, and the hazards are there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and they are extreme. But that said, our job is, of course, to find a way around those hazards. We are, many of us who work for major American media, supported industriously and generously supported by our employers to protect ourselves, which has involved adopting extraordinary measures, which we don't usually discuss very much, to protect ourselves against the sort of thing that has occurred to Jill Carroll, who is still missing today, nearly 2 months after she disappeared. That said, my feeling is that, and I speak not now primarily or exclusively of the New York Times, but of the major American media, and indeed of the brave freelancers like Jill Carroll, who've been there, have been pretty inventive in finding their way around these obstacles. And my feeling is, to put it at its simplest, that everything essential that the American public needs to know to make a decision about this war and what needs to be done, you will find in the American media. Would we like to have greater access? Would we like to linger longer in the markets, in the private homes? Would we like to travel more often out into the hinterland? Would we like to be less dependent on American military transport to get to some of these very endangered places outside Baghdad? Of course we would. But we managed to do it anyway, and I don't think that the American media has much to apologize about for in its coverage of this war.
Sarah, thanks very much for the question. And John Burns, thank you so much for taking time out to speak with us today. We hope we get a chance to talk with you next time you're back in Iraq, which is what, next week?
It will be.
John Burns, the Baghdad bureau chief of the New York Times, as always, thanks very much for speaking with us. We'll be back with more Iraqis to take your calls when we come back from a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're talking about what it's like to live in Iraq 3 years after the U.S. invasion. Our guest is Amelia Templeton, a reporter for War News Radio at Swarthmore College. She's introducing us to some of the contacts that she and her friends there have made over the past year or so as they've tried to find out more about life in Iraq. Part of what life is about in Iraq, Amelia, is bad telephone lines. That's what we're learning as we're trying to get your next contact up to talk with us.
Yeah, that's something we deal with quite frequently. I guess when the electricity cuts in and out and so many services are uncertain in Baghdad, you never know if you're going to be able to contact someone or not.
Mm-hmm. It's always dicing with death a little bit. Let me ask you a question, and I just wonder whether this is an email question that we've got from one of our listeners, Dave. Has the tax burden on Iraqis increased or decreased since the U.S. invasion?
I'm going to give you an iffy answer to that question. I'm not 100% sure, but my understanding of how things worked in Iraq was actually was not a tax-based government. Mm-hmm. It's a government that draws most of its money from oil revenue, and so actually the previous regime was subsidizing a lot of things, gas, food prices, other things like that, and taxes were not a significant part of the structure. I know there's been a lot of struggle over the sort of shift from that kind of economy to and government to a tax-based system. I haven't heard people talk about their tax burden very often, frankly, and I'm not sure if there's a working tax collection going on yet.
Well, we've got another Iraqi up to speak with you. His name is Syed Hossein Kazwini. He's a practicing imam who's been in Karbala since June of 2004. Before that, he was living in the United States. He's been kind enough to speak with us on this program from time to time. And Mr. Kazwini, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you, Mr. Conan. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
We spoke with you, I guess, last about a year ago. At that time, you reported things were hot, electricity unreliable, but that Karbala felt safe. What's changed?
It's substantially safe, like before, and things are going good in Karbala. But I can't say the same for the rest of the cities in Iraq.
What is employment like there? Are people able to find jobs?
Somewhat. There's not a lot of changes. Not a lot of changes occurred from last year. Still, people are complaining of lack of jobs. But you could say relatively, people are doing a little bit better.
Mr. Kazwini, if I can ask you a question. I've heard that houses in Karbala and Najaf have gotten way more expensive in the past few weeks because it is so much safer and because people are leaving Baghdad and moving there. Have you seen that?
A lot of people are leaving Baghdad and certain other provinces. For example, Al-Nahrawan, which is a city made up of both Sunni and Shia citizens. People are leaving Baghdad and other provinces to come to Karbala and Najaf. Yes, rent has gone up in both cities because of this migration.
Is that because it's safer in Karbala?
It's a lot safer in Karbala and in Najaf. Generally, the south, it's a lot safer than Baghdad and certain northern cities.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Lester. Lester is calling us from Miami in Florida.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a quick question. Given that a lot of this violence in Iraq has been caused by religious extremism, do you think the majority of Iraqis support the formation of a secular government or a religious government? And if it's a religious government, what would that mean for the lives of everyday Iraqis, like these ladies that are in parliament and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kazwini?
I think the majority of the people in Iraq are looking for a government, not necessarily secular and not necessarily too religious, but a government that will definitely secure their rights, right of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, a government that will secure their rights. Now, regardless of whether it's secular and or religious, they just want a government that will not prevent them from being free in any sort of aspect.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Lester.
Thank you. Thank you.
And let's bring another voice into the conversation now. And Amelia Templeton, this is Hanin Al-Ibrahim is on the line. Would you introduce us to her, please?
Yeah, sure. Hanin Al-Ibrahim is a 22-year-old. She just graduated in English literature from Baghdad University. She's quite interesting because she spent half of her time at the university under the Hussein regime and half of it sort of during the occupation. And she actually will be coming to the United States on a Fulbright scholarship this summer. So welcome, Hanin.
Oh, thank you.
And congratulations on your graduation, Hanin.
Thanks so much.
These things are never easy. What was it like going to school in the past couple of years?
Well, I attended college in for 4 years. The first 2 years were before the war, and the 2 years were after the war. So those 4 years were extremely difficult. Especially the last 2 years were very difficult because of after the war situation, and we couldn't really go to college every day at a time.
And obviously the security situation was very different, but what was what you were able to study, was that different too?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you well. Can you repeat it?
Yes, I'm sorry. The phone lines are always a problem. Was there a difference in the teachers and what you were able to study during the years that you attended Baghdad University under the Saddam regime and over the past couple of years?
For the teachers, and the subjects and, the stuff we were studying at college, they stayed the same. For the text, the textbook term papers were all the same. We didn't really have, have the ability to change or even to renew the textbooks and to bring a new material to the university because we stayed, because barely, rebuilt some of the libraries and, to revise some of the burned and the stolen books from our libraries. So it was a hard time after the war.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Tom. Tom's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hello. How are you today, my friend?
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. Listen, I'm a firefighter out here in Arizona, and I'm wondering what happens when someone has a heart attack or something. Do they have a working EMS system in Iraq?
Mr. Kazwini, what's going on there in Karbala? Is there an ambulance system that arrives if people get sick?
In certain places in the city, we do have ambulances that do take care of the sick. In our own part of the city, my father and I are working on a hospital. We're trying to raise funds and donations to help the sick in our city. And some people have been generous enough to donate to this project.
Mm-hmm. Hanin, if you were another student at Baghdad University got sick, would there be an ambulance there to help you out?
Well, actually, no. There used to be a clinic, a small clinic in my campus, but it got closed after the war because it was damaged and no one was able to rebuild it. So if a student got sick or something, we have to take it take him or her to the hospital ourselves.
What about fire protection? Do they have fire protection? Or is it done by the military?
Hanin, you first.
Okay, no fire protection in our colleges, actually.
And in Karbala, which is, of course, to the south and, I guess, a bit to the west of Baghdad, Mr. Kazwini?
Unfortunately, no. The fire department isn't too efficient here. Some very rare places in the city are lucky enough to have a fire department place, but I can't say that for the rest of the parts of Kabul.
Tom, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Bye-bye. Let's turn now to Rick. Rick is calling us from Marshall in Michigan.
Hello. Hello. Actually, it's Greg.
Oh, I apologize.
No problem. My question, I guess, goes in a little different direction. I hear a lot about the economics and regime change and religious issues, but something that I don't hear a lot about, and I'd be curious if somebody had a perspective on, is something regarding environmental degradation as a result of, I guess, not just the war, but, you know, over the years, Iraq being perceived as oil. What about more of the natural setting in Iraq, and what have been some of the effects of the past few years on that?
Syed Hossein Kazwini, have you noticed a change since you were there? Were you there as a small child?
The question is on our natural resources.
And on the environment. Obviously, one of the things that, of course, happened during the last years of Saddam's regime was the drying up of the marshlands in southern Iraq and the difficulties faced by many of the marsh Arabs there. I know a project is underway to refill the marshlands there. But from where you are in Karbala, Mr. Kazwini, what do you make of the environment?
It's because Karbala is a very important city in Iraq, it's been given some special attention. I could say that the forest, because Karbala is made up of many forests, they're being somewhat taken care of by the government. It's been given attention, but not as it should be.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with Iraqis in Iraq today, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in from Sam. Sam's calling from Chicago.
Yeah, hi. Am I on the air?
Yes, go ahead, please, Sam.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to ask, I happen to be Jewish. I'd like to ask the imam what they're doing in Iraq differently now in terms of educating. You know, I blame a lot of the terrorism on what they teach their children there in the schools and in the mosques. I'm wondering if that has changed at all.
Imam Kazwini.
To be honest, after the fall of Saddam, the new government and the new politicians, and even it's the job of religious leaders like myself and like my father, is to teach people about peace, about living peacefully with people of different faiths, different religions. But unfortunately, these terrorists and the terrorist acts that are going on, these people, I think they have a political agenda. It's not so much religious, but it's a political thing that it will take a while for people to learn, for these terrorists to learn to live peacefully. But it's the job, it's our job, and it's the job of politicians to teach people about nonviolence and to live peacefully with members, other members of the community.
Well, we'll hope your phone line will last out the last couple of minutes of the program. But let me ask you both. This is an email question we got from Tom Humiston. So much focus is on problems and issues. What do your guests do for recreation? Also, what are good things that have held through everything that's happened? I'd like to hear about those kinds of things to know in what ways we're alike and to feel closer. So let me ask you, Hanin Al-Ibrahim, what do you do for recreation?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? I think there is a problem with the phone line here. I can't hear well.
What do you do for recreation? What do you do for fun?
For fun, okay. Well, actually, I graduated from college about 6 months ago, so I stayed at home. I applied for the scholarship. So for fun, I can't really go out or have fun with my friends out because of the situation here and because there's so many curfews that we have in Baghdad especially. So for fun, I have a blog of my own. I get online so much. I get to talk with people from the USA or from other countries, and that's really my fun. I write short stories, and I do publish them on my blog.
And I wonder, go ahead, please. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Okay, so most of the fun I have, I do is either I get online or read books.
And what do you write about on your blog?
Well, in my blog, I write about the daily life in Iraq, about some personal stories and, you know, events I get through here in Baghdad from college or from my home or with my friends.
And let me put that same question to you, Syed Hossein Kazwini, there in Karbala. What do you do for recreation? I understand because security is so much better. If you wanted to go out at night, you probably could.
Well, Kabila has a very good nightlife, and people go out a lot. But to be honest, Mr. Conan, I really don't have time to have fun, because when we came here, when we left the United States and when we moved to Iraq, we came here to work. And here at our office, at my father's office, Ayatollah Khuzwini, we're always receiving politicians, we're receiving people that come and ask my father for advice. And my father's always giving people directions as to how to help Iraqis live a better life, how to make Iraq a better place. So we're always working night and day, and honestly, we never have time to have fun.
Let's hope that that changes. Let's really hope that that changes. Syed Hossein Khuzwini, thank you very much for being with us, and we'll check back with you from time to time, if you don't mind.
It's a pleasure, Mr. Conan. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you again. We'd also like to thank Hanin al-Ibrahim, a recent graduate of English literature at Baghdad University, who enjoys novels and, as we heard, is running her own blog. Thank you very much for being with. One more question before we let you go. You've graduated. What's the job market like for a brand new graduate of Baghdad University?
Well, for my major, you can, like, for example, I have some friends who worked as translators with American workers here, and also we can apply for, you know, a job in an embassy or in any company, like we translate letters and get the emails and such things. Like, we work on computers, we translate from English to Arabic language.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Hanin al-Ibrahim with us on the line from Baghdad. And thanks also to Amelia Templeton of War News Radio at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for being with us today and for introducing us to some of your contacts in Iraq.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Amelia Templeton with us from Swarthmore College. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.